Well, it's taken half a year, but here in Toronto, the truth is finally, slowly coming out. The truth about what happened this last summer during the G20 protests. Widespread evidence of police brutality, of illegal incarcerations, of police invoking secret laws that may or may not have any legitimacy, a mountain of social media documentation, videos, photographs, first-hand accounts, all of them for months refuted by the powers that be. Well, they're finally catching up to the police of Toronto. TVO's own Steve Paikin, testifying to the House of Commons about the excessive violence he witnessed firsthand against a peaceful journalist who was beaten by police officers during the G20, substantiated claims that police officers removed their name tags so as to avoid later identification for what they were doing during the G20, videotape evidence of cops beating the hell out of people, a blistering report from the Ontario Ombudsman, finally owning up to the fact that for a few days last summer, civil rights, human rights, kinda didn't exist in Toronto. Now, not a fraction of the accusations are being dealt with. There are 400 complaints that are mostly going ignored. But bit by bit, like I said, the truth is coming out. The process, of course, will take a break for the holidays. Both the accused protesters and the police officers and our elected officials will all be able to take a break from the G20 and enjoy the company of their loved ones over the Christmas season, and then get back to the slow process of sorting through the facts. But for at least one Torontonian, there will be no break this Christmas season. Byron Son is still in prison. He wasn't kettled, he wasn't held overnight, he never even showed up to the protest. But he was imprisoned before the G20, and he's been in prison ever since. You'll remember Byron, I spoke about him on this program before. He is not known as a political radical. He is a hacker, an IT security specialist who became a vocal critic of the surveillance apparatus that was erected around the G20. He made it his business to poke that apparatus, to advise other people how they could get around it, to test its limits, to find what the cops were charting and why. He poked the system, and the system poked back. He and his wife were arrested, she has been released, and he has been denied bail twice. He faces weapons charges, mischief charges, a rather obscure charge of intimidating an officer of the court. And though all of this is incredibly unusual and absolutely unlike any other case stemming from the G20, we haven't heard much about it. And the reason for that is because we are not allowed to talk about it. The court has issued a publication ban about Byron Son's case. And so as I proceed today to speak about Byron Son with somebody who actually knew him, I'm going to have to be very careful. I welcome back to Search Engine fellow technology journalist and fellow Jesse Hirsch. Hi, Jesse.
Hello, Jesse.
So I realize that we are going to be really constrained in this conversation because there is a publication ban in effect. Let's start with what we can say and what we said last time we spoke about Byron Son. Can you give listeners just a short recap of his case?
He was arrested the Wednesday before the weekend of the G20 in Toronto under very sensational headlines in terms of terrorism and anti-terror investigation. And all of it, I think, was initially not so much led by the police, but by the media's need to connect that $1 billion budget to some rationalization, some reason. But within 24 hours, a number of Byron's friends came forward and said, look, this is a complete and total misunderstanding, a clash of cultures even between a critic, someone who wanted to really try to hold accountable and empirically try to measure how the money was being spent, the measures that were being taken to militarize the downtown of Toronto. And you know, while the details of the charges, while the details of why he was denied bail, why his appeal for the denial of bail were both unsuccessful, we can't talk about. And that's what makes it even more frustrating, that it started off as a very sensational story and, you know, remains so if only because of the void of information that, you know, we're sort of left at the point that the story gets even more interesting.
Right. So this was sort of initially kind of a tabloid story about this potential bomber living in Forest Hill. And just as details started to emerge that sort of brought this down to earth, and without saying anything speculative, having known him yourself and talked to people who knew him, and even you were present at the surveillance club meetings where he spoke, you have described him to me previously. I'll paraphrase. Your feeling was that this guy has no jihadist or terrorist leanings. This is a standard issue hacker type guy who was interested in how the security apparatus works, was trying to color within the lines to poke the authorities to see what they were watching, whether they were spying on the purchases he made, trying to basically test how free we are in an environment like the pre-G20 surveyed environment.
And as you've sort of rightly pointed out, goes to the heart of the hacker ethic that you know, a lot of people really identify with as a sort of moral response to our technological society. And Byron was very clear at that meeting, in May, sort of when he was publicly, I mean, he wasn't trying to hide any of his activities, and he was being very clear that he had no criminal intent, no violent intent. And what's been interesting is the Free Byron movement and the type of people who have put in the effort to go to the various hearings to really learn about the case in spite of the publication ban, i.e. directly, by literally participating in the larger court process, by sitting in the audience, and by visiting Byron, by going to the Maplehurst Correctional Center, that it's their interest, I think, that really gives, I think, a real insight into what's occurring in this trial. That what they worry about is that it's the hacker itself, the hacker ethic that's on trial, that the ability to criticize technology, the ability to criticize the way technology is potentially abused under the guise of security, that's their concern, that's what is being attacked, and that if, you know, this trial doesn't get the attention, if Byron doesn't get the support that they feel is necessary, then as a society, we won't value that role of the hacker. Quite to the contrary, we'll continue with its criminalization, so that not only is it discouraged, but then people can be punished legally, in this essence, just exploring the technology of their world.
Coming this Christmas, the guy will have been locked up for 6 months, right? Is that right?
Correct.
And he has been denied bail a couple times now.
His first bail hearing, I believe, was over 8 weeks, which is an incredible amount of time. But it was all because all the parties involved knew that there would be an appeal. So they wanted to be as thorough as possible, anticipating the scrutiny that would come. And, of course, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, a justice of the peace is not necessarily a career a legal professional. A justice of the peace is meant to be someone who, like a jury, represents the public. And that may be why it took longer to really understand the implications of the law and how they applied. But the appeal to that hearing itself also took, I believe, close to 8 weeks. And it really speaks, I think, to the potential precedent that may be set, regardless of how this particular case goes down, but also the intense amount of resources that the Crown has put in to really making sure that they, to the full extent of the law, prosecute Byron, which is the sheer manpower, the sheer hours that are being spent prosecuting this case for, you know, what appears to many as being without merit.
The reasons why an accused person might be denied bail, I mean, like, it's either they're a flight risk or they're too dangerous to be set free. Is there any other reason that they could be holding him? I mean, those are the reasons you would deny somebody bail.
Legally speaking, those are the reasons. And obviously the publication ban means I can't really speak to, you know, how the court interpreted the applicability of those reasons.
Right. So you were there for one of these hearings or both of them?
I went to the decision for the first bail hearing. I didn't go to the second, if only because cynically I knew its outcome.
Yeah.
And I found the first really emotionally difficult. And I even went, like, you know, that day I sent notes to three lawyers I knew asking them about the publication ban, saying, look, I need to share this story. It's like being exposed to trauma. You have to process it. Otherwise, it just festers.
Well, this is deeply disturbing for people like us. We have, you know, it's our job to try to keep the public informed about this kind of stuff. You have information about this that you are passionate about, that you feel needs to get out there, and you are legally not allowed to share that information.
And that is what is so frustrating. And part of it is because of how this really speaks to one's ability to share that information in the first place. Like, it's such a self-referential case in terms of media and technology and, you know, a freedom of speech, and to not then be able to talk about these issues is...
Well, it's right on the beat that you and I share, and then you actually know the dude. You are so close to this story.
Well, and what makes it even more frustrating, and this is important to state for the record, is this is not a publication ban that's coming from the Crown. This is a publication ban that's coming from the defense. Because the defense is concerned, and while I don't totally agree with it, I certainly understand its rationale, is that the televised media, the non-internet media, will reduce this to sound bites that do not portray Byron in a positive light.
Okay, so let's hold on that for a second, because a publication ban can happen in a couple of different ways. But if the defendant asks for a publication ban, then the judge must grant it. So we're allowed to say this. It was Byron's son who asked for the publication ban?
It was his lawyers, yes. You know, it was certainly their strategic decision that allowing this trial to be reported into the public would impinge upon his right to a fair trial.
That is interesting to me and a little bit curious, because assuming I will have to be hypothetical here and assume this, because the truth is we don't know definitively. Assuming he was never a terrorist, assuming that he did this to publicize and inform the public about their freedoms and about the security apparatus, if we're going to work on that assumption, then he wants a conversation about this kind of stuff. And the whole idea is, if he should get into trouble, that becomes a bit of a theatrical event so that we can all see how free we are, how much the cops are spying on, whether or not they can get you even if you don't break a law. So it's strange to me that it's coming from Byron Son's camp, that publication ban.
Well, and this speaks, I think, to the cultural differences between the legal world and the media world, that, you know, we understand power within the court of public opinion, but they understand power within the court of law. And his lawyers have one interest and one interest only, which is representing the best interests of their client, even if their client's interest is to have a larger public debate.
Presumably he agreed to this, though. I mean,
one assumes, but also one assumes he was in not the same situation he was when initially deciding he wanted to have a public debate.
Right. So when he was sitting at home at his computer trying to get conversation going, it wasn't when he was in jail for a few months. So, I mean, you know, we're having a chuckle here. The guy's been in prison for 6 months. I mean, this is a traumatic thing for a guy who is not really have much of a background as a career criminal, or probably never spent a day in jail in his life.
And I think he's, you know, rightfully so, never assumed that this would be the case. I mean, this is, again, why the support it has been so strong, why anytime there's been a hearing, the courtroom has been full of, you know, misfit looking computer nerds who, you know, are just as law abiding, just as respectful of the rule of law, but yet still critical of power and how power can wield technology. And they're scared that in this case, they too could be subject to the same type of misunderstanding. And to paraphrase what I've heard a number of them sort of describe, is it's kind of the Revenge of the Nerds movie in a very tragic and real scenario, in which the jocks, i.e. the police and the Crown, have no concept of the nerds and the nerds' lifestyle, but just deeply suspect and fear them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what's been playing out in this courtroom, because it is absurd. And that's the tragedy of the publication ban, is that the whole thing has a level of surrealism that would be an internet phenomenon. And I still stand by my initial assertion that when the publication ban is finally lifted, he will be a cause celebre globally. The same way that when his arrest made global headlines, the trial is going to make global headlines because it is so absurd.
If his defense or even if he was concerned that the media would continue to sensationalize this rather than downplay. I mean, you know, the truth is there was the first day when it was sensationalized, and then it seemed like there was a coming down to earth. The Toronto Star maybe unfortunately worded this, but they said, oh, he seems like a middle-aged white guy, not your average terrorist. So it seemed like there was a little bit of a recognition on their part that maybe they were mischaracterizing this guy. I take issue with the idea that the press would have just continued to paint this guy as this mad bomber. I mean, maybe it would have been beneficial to him. But once the trial actually begins, you're saying we will have a hotly followed trial of the geeks, basically.
Yes. Although, to be clear, and this is, I think, centered more on the defense's concern, I think there's a real division between, let's say, TV news and online media. So globally, everyone will be accessing this on the internet and they'll understand the truth. But locally, there's a ton of people who get their news from the local CP24, the local global news. And those are the people who may not get the truth. Those are the people who may not get the geek side. And those are the people who may be the jury. Those are the people who may be more connected by proximity to the actual trial that the defense is concerned about. And I think there's a valid reason, because in spite of the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail doing a 180 in their coverage, televised news did not.
Yeah.
You know, it's not within their capacity to do that. They've got 60 seconds, and that 60 seconds, if it bleeds, it leads. They're not going to tell you the terrorist wasn't a terrorist. He's going to keep being a terrorist until well after the trial's done. And maybe then they'll say, oh, by the way, he's just a nerd.
I got to ask you this, though, because, and this was something that was sort of hinted to earlier when you said, well, you know, he's in a different frame of mind now than he was, you know, when he was starting to poke at the apparatus. Now he's a guy in jail who's very concerned about his freedom and with cause to be concerned about his freedom. These are serious charges he's up against. He's been in prison for 6 months. Who knows where his frame of mind is at? If we are expecting this guy to come out and sort of be a poster boy for net freedom and against police surveillance, is it possible that he is whipped? Is it possible that he's beaten and he's going to... I mean, there's a lot of potential embarrassment for the authorities here. They have him on these charges of possession of explosives and dangerous weapons, this really strange charge of intimidation of a justice system participant, which I think was cooked up to stop mafiosos from threatening jurors. I don't know how they're coming at him. I guess we can't talk about the grounds for that charge, but it's a very obscure and weird charge. A mischief charge, which is a pretty vague charge that's often used when they got nothing else to throw at somebody. They might just offer him a plea, and he might be really inclined to take it.
And given the amount of jail time he's already served, and given that usually pretrial custody is credited at 2-1, they could say, all right, we'll sentence you to a year, time served, and you're free to go. So I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, I have to say, if I was in his situation and they came to me and said, you know, sign this and we'll let you go, I certainly would be tempted, because, you know, he has, his life has been absolutely completely thrown upside down. It's also worth pointing out that his wife is still under house arrest. And she's not allowed, because she's also charged. And she's, well, granted, not in jail. She's not allowed to, A, talk to him, talk to any of her friends, have a life.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, a lot of reason for them to just sort of say, we totally underestimated the response we were going to get.
Look for someone else. We don't want to be front and center for this.
Yeah. Yeah. And no one would blame them. I mean, that would be a perfectly natural human response. But nonetheless, at that point, the publication ban would be lifted.
Yeah.
And you and I would still be able to talk about the merits of this case, which will be a fascinating conversation when we're able to have it.
And a necessary conversation. And I say this, you know, you might think I got my tongue in my cheek, but we have to keep our minds open to the possibility that this guy, the authorities had it right. And maybe this guy had some intent to hurt people. And, you know, we don't know all the facts yet. And some of the facts that you know about, Jesse, you can't talk about. But if that is not the case, if these charges were trumped up, if this guy has been denied his freedom for 6 months and counting with no real cause, then there is a conversation that's going to have to happen. And I think that whatever influence you have on mainstream media and whatever you and I can do to just provide some sort of a counterbalance to it, to a lot of the talk that's going out there, I look forward to that conversation with you and having it elsewhere as well.
As do I.
Jesse Hirsch, thanks again.
Always a pleasure, Jesse.
Search Engine is produced by me with help from Luke Simcoe and a community of listeners who are hereby deputized to enforce their own secret laws. Remember to remove your name tags first, guys. Email me with story tips and freelance pitches at jesse@jessebrown.ca. The blog is at tvo.org/search engine. New videos going up at youtube.com/tvosearchengine. And I'm on Twitter at Jesse Brown. This program is released with a Creative Commons license, so you can go ahead and sample part of it in your next hip-hop track, like listener Matt Finlay did. The song is called The Virus. Google Matt Finlay and The Virus. It's pretty good. This is the last show of the season. I'll take a two-week break and be back in 2011 with more Search Engine. Thanks for listening this year.